It's Thursday, November 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, an historic meeting is set for the presidents of China and Taiwan.
When I saw the happiness and the lucky faces of the children, I thought this is exactly what we have to do.
Europe begins to implement its migrant relocation plan. Also ahead, what does a failed casino business say about a U.S. presidential hopeful? We hear about new songs that are 20 years old. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. Taiwan says its president, Ma Ying-jeou, and his Chinese counterpart, Xi Jinping, will meet in Singapore Saturday, the first such meeting of the two leaders since the end of the Chinese Civil War in 1949, which ended nationalist rule on the mainland and ushered in a communist government. China scholar Dolly Young of the University of Chicago told VOA's Victor Beatty the timing of Saturday's meeting is crucial as Taiwan's pro-Beijing nationalist party, the KMT, of President Ma, who's been in power since 2008, faces a tough campaign leading to elections in January against the main opposition Democratic Progressive Party. Still, he sees the meeting as a milestone.
The two sides, as you know, have been divided from each other for such a long time, and relations have been delicate, but certainly they have eased very much. In fact, cross-strait relations are no longer almost like a hotspot in global politics, but nonetheless, they remain extremely important. So in essence, this is truly a milestone in terms of global relations, and especially in terms of regional peace.
Why now?
President Ma Ying-jeou is actually scheduled to step down in May 2016. But the elections are heating up already on Taiwan, and his party, the Kuomintang, is running behind at this point. And in fact, the election will be held in January, and that means actually if the Kuomintang loses, then there is an extremely narrow window and there would be a very limited possibility for him to undertake any new initiative. So doing that before January allows him to stake a historic claim in terms of being the first president, first leader of Taiwan to meet with his counterpart in the PRC on the mainland. But at the same time, I think the political calculations are such that such a meeting will also help to enhance the position of the KMT, the Kuomintang, as the campaign, especially as they have replaced the presidential candidate recently. So in that sense, that's also very important. For the mainland, of course, for President Xi Jinping, he's undertaken a variety of initiatives, and this is just another avenue through which he's showing that he is of the leadership quality that he can undertake and certainly make decisive decisions when needed, and he's willing to go forward with such a meeting at relatively short notice.
Chinese mainland policy toward Taiwan hasn't changed. In fact, they have missiles pointed at Taiwan.
Yes, but at the same time, trade relations have warmed. In fact, Taiwan relies on the mainland for 40% of its exports. So in that sense, actually, the two sides are economically very heavily integrated already. At the same time, there are actually sort of a huge number of people, as many as 1 million people from Taiwan. This is an island of 23 million people. So as many as 1 million live and work on the mainland. At the same time, there are really many tourists from the mainland who are visiting Taiwan. Some students are also studying in Taiwan universities. So exchanges between the two sides have dramatically strengthened in recent years and leading to better understanding and, of course, interactions in various spheres.
The two leaders are expected to exchange views on cross-strait issues. What might that involve?
This meeting harks back to the so-called 1992 consensus on one country. Both sides agreed to there being one China, subject to different interpretations, essentially. But nonetheless, it's known as the one China principle. This is an effort by both sides to stabilize relations, especially under the one China rubric.
Dolly Young sees the meeting as potentially giving a boost to the ruling KMT party in Taiwan ahead of January's national poll after suffering a sharp setback last year in local elections. Public opinion in Taiwan over the past 20 years has consistently showed overwhelming support for the status quo, with little support for reunification with the mainland. Well, if you are of a certain age, you probably remember the humble beginnings of space travel. And if you're a little bit younger, that's about all you've known. And a lot of us have wanted to go into space. Now we possibly have the chance. We turn now to our social media segment and our international edition social media guru, G. Abby Lee, who's here in Studio 22. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim.
What do you have?
So I do have great news for you because, as you said, you can apply to be an astronaut one day. Starting December 14th, NASA is accepting applications for being one. It's a U.S. government agency responsible for a civilian space program and aerospace research. NASA tweeted the news Wednesday, and it's getting astronomical response. Sorry, I couldn't help myself, from Twitter users.
Well, I'm ready to go. Tell us about the tweet.
Sure. NASA is on Twitter at NASA and sent out 5 tweets related to the news. One of them reads like this. Did you hear? You can apply to be #BeAnAstronaut starting on December 14th. Here are the details, and it has a link to the website. It's spreading the news on many social media outlets. For example, since about 10 minutes ago, one of its astronauts, Christina Koch, began a Q&A session on Facebook. She's also on Twitter, at @Astro_Christina.
Okay, now, before we get too many of our listeners excited, what does this mean and what does it take?
Well, you can find detailed information on NASA's website /astronauts, but to give you a shorter answer, there are 3 basic requirements. First, you need a bachelor's degree in a STEM field, which is an acronym for science, technology, engineering, and math education. Second, you have to have at least 3 years of related professional experience. And third, you have to pass a NASA astronaut physical.
Okay, so on Twitter, how big is interest out there?
Well, the first tweet was sent out about 7 hours ago, and since then, nearly 5,000 tweets use the #BeAnAstronaut. And I'm sure that number will increase throughout today.
Wonderful. Jim? Thank you so much for being here, G. She tweets for us on our VOA International Edition Twitter account at @VOA_IE. And you can also follow her on her own account at G. Abby Lee, and perhaps one day from space. This is VOA.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. Europe has begun relocating the first refugees from Greece to other EU states under its plan to tackle the migrant crisis. Brussels wants hundreds of thousands of refugees to be resettled, but there's strong opposition from some members, as Henry Ridgewell tells us from London.
Athens Airport, the departure point for 30 Syrian and Iraqi refugees chosen to be among the first beneficiaries of the EU relocation plan. They were flown Wednesday to their new home in Luxembourg, avoiding the brutal journey by foot through the Balkans and Eastern Europe and bypassing the often prolonged application for asylum. En route, the refugees voiced their gratitude.
Luxembourg.
You happy?
Luxembourg, happy.
Very happy. Happy.
Among those bidding them farewell was EU Parliament President Martin Schulz.
When I saw the happiness and the lucky faces of the children, I thought this is exactly what we have to do.
Schulz called for all EU states to take part in the relocation plan, which envisages 160,000 refugees being shared across the European Union. But there has been opposition from several eastern member states, as Pavel Swiedlicki of the policy group Open Europe explains.
It's not really for Martin Schulz to say what is fine and what is not fine, because it's really for national governments. And we saw that although there was a majority to agree to the relocation scheme, a number of governments protested and a number of governments voted very unwillingly.
On the Greek islands, thousands more migrants continue to arrive every day. A strike by ferry workers left many stranded at the dockside in Lesbos Wednesday. Swiedlicki says the new plan will barely begin to tackle the wider problems.
With the 30 refugees taken from Greece to Luxembourg, this now takes us to a total of 116. So still many, many thousands off the target. And that's not even to mention the addressing the broader crisis.
Greece is at the front line of that crisis. Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras issued a warning to EU partners.
Να μην ενθαρρύνουμε χερσαίες ή θαλάσσιες.
He said Europe should not encourage the out-of-control land or sea travel from Turkey to the rest of Europe that puts human lives at risk. For the vast majority of migrants, the journey to a new life in Europe is increasingly dangerous. Temperatures in the transit Balkan countries are falling fast. Aid agencies warn that thousands of lives will soon be at risk. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Here in the United States, Donald Trump has been gathering huge crowds and sitting at or near the top of voter polls as he seeks the Republican Party nomination to run for president in 2016. Behind the campaign rhetoric, we sought to find out how well the billionaire businessman might lead the United States based on his corporate experience. Nina Burley is a national politics correspondent for Newsweek and joins us after investigating Donald Trump's past casino business interests in Atlantic City, New Jersey. Nina, how did Trump become involved in this?
Atlantic City made a bet in 1976 or 1978 after the people of New Jersey voted to legalize casino gambling that the more casinos, the better. And so Donald Trump came in the late 80s, early 90s, at the very beginning, and he did very well for a while. But what happened was other states in the Northeast corridor realized pretty quickly that, wow, that is the way to make money, funding your roads and your education. So the casinos started to proliferate. So as Donald Trump came in there already with a large amount of debt, he had problems even before the competition from the other states, and he was filing bankruptcies, as he puts it strategically, as early as 1991. You know, he often says, I left Atlantic City before it cratered, or Atlantic City's a disaster, I got out of there with my money. And so we thought, well, let's go to Atlantic City and see what that means to the people of Atlantic City. And that's what I did.
And what did you find when you got there? What was the, quote, Trump effect?
Well, I mean, the first thing I want to say is Atlantic City is not a disaster. The boardwalk was lovely. The beach is lovely, and there are still a lot of thriving businesses. The first thing that I learned from numerous sources independently was that his business was notorious for not paying contracts in full. The unemployment of casino workers in Atlantic City is so drastic that the United States government had to pump in, I think, $25 million to do job training and to support these people. So leaves one with the impression that Donald Trump, for all of the good that he did for that city, which was he was a great impresario coming down from New York, bringing glitzy stars and world-class boxing matches and so on to this little beachfront community. For all of that, on balance, he did not leave Atlantic City better off than he found it. For somebody running for president, one might hold them to a certain standard that's higher than just the businessman who's taking the money and leaving.
Certainly through one's business career, there are going to be ups, there are going to be downs, there are going to be evolutions in the way that businesses are run. Do we have any indication that Donald Trump's other businesses were run in a similar manner to that you have seen in Atlantic City?
Well, you know, I didn't do a lot of research into his post-Atlantic City business career. There is a book that I referred to when I was working on this called Trump Nation by a journalistic colleague of mine. We don't work for the same company, but it's called, his name is Timothy O'Brien. The sense that I got from that, and I glossed the last part of the book, is that when he was back in New York, when he was out of Atlantic City, some of the more brash moves, perhaps, he learned from those things, and he wasn't doing that anymore. He still talks the talk that we are familiar with here in New York. He's brash, blustery. As far as the businesses, I think that he toned it down some after the Atlantic City years.
It's a fascinating insight into how Donald Trump operated among the high rollers in Atlantic City. Your article is online on Newsweek.com, Trump's Big Atlantic City Dump. Nina Burley, national politics correspondent for Newsweek, thank you so much for joining us.
You're most welcome.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Her music defined the sound of a generation in the mid-1990s, and now Canadian-born singer and artist Alanis Morissette has reissued her groundbreaking CD, Jagged Little Pill. As International Edition's David Byrd reports, Jagged Little Pill Collector's Edition includes 10 unreleased songs from that same era.
Alanis Morissette was only 19 years old when her third CD, Jagged Little Pill, exploded on the music scene in 1995. The Canadian-born singer-songwriter's first single, You Oughta Know, encapsulated many of the emotions she and other young women were feeling at the time. Morissette says that the song, which earned her the reputation of being an angry songwriter, was a reaction to a life of trying to please others, and then finally being able to express her true self.
Because You Oughta Know came out of the gate first, I think that was a label that stuck. And, you know, I'll take it as a woman and as a feminist at the time and still now. If there were to be one horrifying label that's going to be stuck onto me, I'll take angry because it's so lovely. It's such a powerful force. Not the destructive version, but the one that inspires action. I'll take it.
It's like rain.
Morissette and co-writer Glenn Ballard came up with many of the songs in Ballard's studio in Encino, California. The two would write music together, and Morissette would write the lyrics. Now 41 years old, with a husband and a young son, Alanis Morissette says that time seems like just a few days ago.
It's definitely a different lifetime, though, for me. And yet there is this thread of continuity that's remained the same since when I was 2 years old, 19 years old. Now there's a sameness.
I'm high, but I'm grounded. I'm sane, but I'm overwhelmed. I'm lost, but I'm hopeful, baby.
Jagged Little Pill earned Morissette 4 Grammy Awards and has sold more than 33 million copies. Now the singer has her own monthly podcast called Conversations with Alanis Morissette. She says the podcast, which features conversations with authors, doctors, educators, scientists, and artists, is a natural outgrowth of her life. And what about music? Well, Elena says she has a plan for a new album, but she wants to finish her book first.
I'm always writing songs, so I have about 15 new songs, and I had promised myself for a long time to finish this book that I'm writing, so it's holding the music hostage in the sweetest way. So I'll finish this book, I'm almost done, and then the second I'm done, I'll give myself probably 2 days off, and then I'll start writing again.
Alanis Morissette's Jagged Little Pill, the collector's edition, is available now. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
Years ago for Alanis Morissette? My goodness, I'm still trying to figure out why the Beatles broke up. You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us any time of the day or night at our website, voanews.com. We're also on Twitter, our handle at @VOA_IE. Big thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Dan Crafton. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We'd definitely love to thank you for joining us and getting all the way through the end of our program. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Come back again and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service announced this month that it is listing the military and great green macaws as endangered under the Endangered Species Act. Both bird species are endemic to Central and South America. The agency found that both species are in decline, primarily due to habitat loss, fragmentation and degradation, small population size, and poaching. Further, the existing regulatory mechanisms designed to protect these macaws are not adequate to prevent those threats from impacting them throughout their ranges. As a result, both macaws are at risk of extinction throughout their ranges. The military macaw inhabits tropical, semi-deciduous forests in Mexico and South America. Although it is a large distribution, its population, ranging from 6,000 to 13,000 adults, is highly fragmented into small, localized groups, ranging from a few pairs to approximately 100 individuals. The great green macaw occupies humid, tropical forests primarily in Central America and parts of northern South America. Its population, now ranging from 1,000 to 3,000 individuals, is in decline. The service recognizes the valuable, ongoing conservation efforts to protect these species by a number of private individuals, national and local governments, and non-governmental organizations, including the Wildlife Conservation Society and Fundación Pro Aves. These efforts include providing training to local communities to monitor populations and studying species via satellite transmitters to determine the species' home range and specific habitat. However, in spite of these notable contributions, great green and military macaw populations continue to decline. As a result of this listing, certain activities involving these two bird species will be prohibited without a permit, including import into and export out of the United States, take, defined by the Endangered Species Act as harm, harass, kill, or injure within the United States, and interstate and foreign commerce. By regulating these activities, the Endangered Species Act ensures that U.S. citizens and individuals subject to the jurisdiction of the United States do not contribute to the further decline of these species. The United States is actively engaged with conservation partners and the public in the search for improved and innovative ways to conserve and recover the imperiled military and the great green macaw and other threatened species.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.